You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
And welcome to the show. Stuart Goldsmith here with the Comedian's Comedian, bringing you the inside scoop by scooping inside the minds of all of your favourite comedians and finding out their creative processes, their drives, their desires, what makes them tick, and crucially, whether or not they're happy. Today, we're going to be hearing from Elf Lyons. Now, this interview was recorded during the Edinburgh Festival this year at the Place Hotel. Thanks to the Place Hotel on York Place in Edinburgh for your kind offer of rehearsal space. But since this episode was recorded, Elf is currently out of action. I'm going to read a statement from Elf, which will tell us exactly what's going on. A mixture of cordo equina and degenerative disc disease caused her to cancel a few gigs, which has annoyed her. After suffering a health scare post-Medusa, that's a show of hers, where she lost all feeling in her genitals and mobility in her lower half, she is currently repairing at home after time in hospital before going back to hospital to fix her spine and thus protect her legs and her genitals, which she loves so dearly. So we wish her all the best. I'm using the royal we there. I, and I'm sure everyone else involved with the podcast and listening to it, wish Elf all the best. She's a phenomenally accomplished comedian. She's a brilliant comic. She's a very funny clown. Her stuff is part of, I suppose, the new wave of clowning, which is, I don't even know if clowning is the right title for what she does, but it's kind of devised, very creative, written pieces, singing. She throws everything at it. Her show at the Edinburgh Festival 2 years ago was called Swan Lake. No, it wasn't. It was called Chiff Chaff, in which she attempted to do a one-woman Swan Lake in French without speaking French or being able to do ballet. So it's that kind of territory, right? She is one of the absolute best at stuff like this. And as you will hear, is enormously kind of academically rigorous and structurally innovative, as well as being very, very funny. So terribly sad and distressed to hear about Elf's current medical predicament. I'm not sure the extent to which what she's suffering from can be recovered from, but all of our love to Elf, and I hope that anything that can happen to her that is positive does. And while I remember, if you are signed up to the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, not only can you get extra content from loads of episodes and all future episodes with extra bits, you can also get hold of the QI Elves Pod Smash when the No Such Thing as a Fish podcast performers and creators, all four of them, came onto the Comedian's Comedian live at the King's Place Podcast Festival in London. That is released early and available now to people who've signed up to the Insiders Club. So all of that said, big love to Elf. This is Elf Lyons.
So let's just talk about how you safeguard your mental health during the festival. Yeah. That's the sort of thing we'd normally get to around minute 40. But let's open with it, seeing as we've started talking about it naturally.
Straight into it.
This is your 11th Fringe.
Yeah.
So talk me through the last 11th Fringe. I don't want there to be too heavy a Fringe emphasis on this because it might not go out for a few months. But just, we're here. So yeah. Talk to me about the the how this is your 11th. I had no idea this was your 11th Fringe.
Well, they're not all doing stand-up shows, so because I was all into a catchphrase my dad was always telling me about, you want to be like the captain of the ship, someone who knows but who no longer handles the ropes. So if you want to be good at what you want to do, you've got to understand all the elements of it. So I first came up when I was 17, 18, I can't remember the exact age, and I came up and I was working as a volunteer at the Forest Fringe.
Yes.
And the Forest Cafe, so I was sort of making, you know, coffees and setting up weird experimental theatre practices and trying to rally audiences for free fringe shows and making sure the tech didn't go wrong. Then I was running the bar and just doing lots of, you know, really interactive, cleaning the venue before it started. And so it was a pretty intense time, just working non-stop, obviously, for free.
With a view to using this, as your dad had described, to understand the situation, like with a clear plan to, I'm going to be super involved in this, so I'm going to start at the bottom.
Well, I think you need to have an understanding and a respect for it, because I can't stand it when people don't have, you know, respect for technicians or stage management or bar staff or everyone who manages and makes a venue exist. So it was good knowledge for me to also take into account that you have a 10-minute changeover. And, you know, the technical difficulties.
Absolutely, I understand where you're coming from. What I'm trying to get at is whether you were there thinking, I'm going to be a big part of this. The Fringe is going to be a big part of my life. I'll start gently and understand it. Or whether you were just there for fun and that decision to really get into it came later.
I had no, because I didn't know the Fringe existed until I was about 17. And then I just went up there for the first time volunteering. So I had no idea. It was a complete initiation, baptism by fire. It was sort of a bit like a sexual awakening and an emotional awakening. It was just an awakening. It was such an awakening. I went insane. Yeah. And then I came back and then I worked as a technician at the Gilded Balloon for a bit. And I teched Jess Foster Q's show. And then I did, you know, terrible improv shows with my university. And then I directed an opera and I did opera stuff at like the Palace and Surgeons, you know, all the different venues. So the Space, Palace, Sea Venue, you know, I've been in all of them.
Right.
I've been with them all. And then I started doing like double handers when I started to go, actually, I definitely want to do comedy, because I thought maybe I'd want to be a director or a writer and I wasn't entirely sure. So I thought it's better because you don't need to pick your career immediately at a young age. You can have multiple different careers. And nowadays, everyone has to be a slash. It seems you can't just be a writer. You have to be a writer slash project manager slash...
Yeah, or not even slash. They have to be all one word, like the German. Like, I'm a writer, producer, director, performer, actor, manager. Yeah.
With the hyphen. So, God, it probably sounds really boring, but I just worked. Just really focused on trying to be really good at it all. And I was really bad at so much. I realised I'm an awful prop maker. I'm so bad at costumes. I'm a good lighting designer. I can do sound. But, oh, my God, anything to do with production, as in producing, I can't do.
But that's a valuable piece of knowledge to know that there are things you're not good at. Like, let's not waste my time doing this in the team because I'll screw it up.
I think that was one of my best learning lessons was I think I was in charge of props for a show at university and I lost all of them. Like, how is that possible? And the lady, Pam Tate, who was in charge of props in the costume department, went, you were never allowed to borrow a prop from the costume department ever again. And I said, okay.
And who were you? Given that you are quite young, you're in your 20s, and you are... I think the first time I ever heard your name, I think, was probably Isabel from Comedy for Kids, saying, oh, Elf's great. You know, and I was like, Elf? Who's called Elf? And I think at the time I wasn't sure whether she meant you were one of the kids in Comedy for Kids doing stand up or with, like, did you ever do that? Am I completely wrong in that? You did Comedy for Kids as a gig, rather
as a gig, not as a child.
You weren't as a child. Fine, okay. Well, you might be a child.
I don't know how long she's been running it for, but
well,
I'm pretty sure.
I think we're at the stage now that there are certainly people who could be performing here professionally.
Who were children
in Comedy for Kids.
Oh, wow.
But that's a non-starter in this case, because you're clearly not...
I'm a woman. I'm a woman.
Comedy for women. It's a very different slide.
Yeah. Oh, God. Comedy Club for Kids is still the gig that makes me the most nervous.
Why?
Because it's so much, everyone's so much more brutally honest. And you've got two layers. You've got children and you've got adults. And you've got all these things that you can't do. So you've got these rules that you can't swear, you can't be overly sexual, you can't... Improvising you can obviously do, but, I mean, I'm quite an aggressive performer, so I have to rewrite my persona when I come on stage. And at the same time, you can't be too playful and innocent, because then the children think you're talking down to them.
Yeah,
so there's this
true.
Constant yeah. balance. And I love kids, but I also think, like, I'm a really uncool aunt. Like,
yes.
I just come across as being... I'm not cool to children at all. I'm just a really weird, long person. So.
For the benefit of the listener who is not familiar with the visuals of Elf and has not troubled themselves to look at the photo which will accompany this episode, when you arrived today, I've been this morning reading to toddlers, my own and other people's, in our festival flat, and you look like a Quentin Blake drawing of a cool aunt. I think to just visualise that, that's what you look and dress like.
I'm just incredibly long. Oh, like the amount of times people come up to me and randomly say, excuse me, have you got Marfan syndrome? Out of nowhere. Marfan syndrome, which I think is something to do when you're incredibly long.
Okay.
And it's something to do with heart disease. But
do
I don't
you,
know.
Have you ever looked into it?
I don't believe I've got Marfan syndrome. But people, I clearly have enough of an odd shape about me that people feel the need to come up to me and just double check if I've been to a doctor.
Do you think your, I'm going to say your length, do you think, to use your term, your longness, your length, do you think it is part of why you are a performer?
Probably. I mean, I was always long. I was just this long, sloping, gangly child. And every time at primary school, my parents were constantly being contacted, asked if they'd fed me. And they had. All I did was eat.
You did a show that I saw last year called Swan Lake. You were an ungainly long child. And we speculated as to whether your length as a human being, your physical height, might be something to do with your journey into performance.
Yeah.
We might get back into a little bit of that later on. But you did this show, Swan Lake, in which you deliberately bit off more than you could chew and attempted to do the whole of Swan Lake in an hour in a parrot costume. It made my wife cry with laughing, and I gushed to you and to the listener about what a wonderful thing that is. That's one of, you're one of five or six performers that have ever done that, and I'm always inordinately impressed. I loved it as well, but for me that's a real badge of honour.
Because I think you came on like the fifth or sixth. You came very early.
Very early in the run,
and the show changed so much. I think I only finished the show really in Australia. Because the day you came, I remember it was the day I first decided to use the fairy lights. Because every day my challenge was I'd bring in a new prop and just try and see if I can incorporate something new.
Okay.
And that was the day I did in the fairy lights, which became a real hit for the rest of the show. And then that's the bra striptease, when I take all the bras
yes.
out and then they get more and more convoluted and ridiculous. And then I'm really glad you enjoyed it. The aim was I wanted to have fun. That was all I wanted to do.
You were shining with fun. You had that quality that Spencer Jones has. When you walk out on stage, you see his eyes and you go, this person is absolutely having the time of their lives.
Yeah.
And then you as an audience go, I'm in.
Yeah, that's it. If you can't have fun with it. It's what I've been really struggling with recently with this show, Chiff Chaff. That I've been building, because I haven't had any time to make it, because my way of working, and that might sound pretentious, is, you know, you go to like a 10-minute, you do a 10-minute spot or a 20-minute spot, you just muck about and you fail.
You can say fuck about.
Can I? Okay, you can fuck about. Oh God, I feel so rude. And you can make as many mistakes as possible, and you could be shit and da da da. And you take away from it, and you remember what you enjoyed, and you build the show from that. It's almost. Yeah, it's just, you're just fleshing it out. Because I can't think in 5-minute sets, 10-minute sets, 20-minute sets. That's too constrictive for me, and I don't enjoy that. I find it too prescription-y. But with, because I've been doing Swan up until May, and then suddenly having 2 months to not just make, it's coming up with a fully formed concept album, basically.
Yes.
I've been really struggling, and it's only in the last 2 days, because when you came to see the show, I I just thought, right, I'm just going to improvise it, and I don't really care. I just don't... I know it's... I feel like it's going to be a really good show eventually. I think it's going to be a beautiful show eventually, but right now, I still don't know what it is. And so it's changed a lot since you've last seen it, because I've added in new sound effects, I've taken out the prisoner's dilemma, mm-hmm. I now have water coming out of me after I give birth to Earth. There are loads of new bits that I've added in. It's just been a really... I've only started to enjoy myself now on stage again with the show. And yesterday was the first time I went on stage. I don't think about how long I've got left on stage. I'm in this.
Yes, yes. Okay, well, let's talk about vulnerability. How vulnerable... We talked a little bit in the Lost tapes about...
the Lost tapes.
About vulnerability and the difference between... Chris Krauss...
They wrote a book called I Love Dick, which is beautiful and is not as smutty as you would think from the title. Really fascinating book. Sort of reinvents, in my opinion, like the way a novel is written. But there's a bit in it they write about sincerity and being genuine and how men are often seen as being, and I will quote this incorrectly, but men, she says, are deemed more often as being genuine and sincere because they can say, wow, I thought that was fantastic, and wow, I'm being really honest and listen to the way I'm talking to you about one real thing and I'm really saying it to you, eye contact intense. While women are more seen as being hysterical, which in some respects could be seen as being more honest, because honesty is being conflicting in your emotions and jumping from being angry to sad to aroused to everything, and that vibrancy and that fire can be overwhelming to people, and it's hard to realise that is actual truth.
Yes, so, whereas men have kind of like shut all of that down, mm-hmm. and gone, I am performing sincerity and that is actual sincerity. Yeah.
And we were mentioning it in the Lost tapes before Stuart fucked up. Joking. Only recently feeling like I learnt how to be a human, because for such a long time you're performing what it means to be vulnerable. Going, oh God, I can't believe I said that. I'm such a fool.
Yeah, and that's lovely that you slip into the voice of the ingenue that you're currently performing in Chiff Chaff. That's a really... I must confess to some disappointment when I came and you didn't begin in the French accent that you did the whole of Swan Lake with. I just loved it so much.
I love the French accent. It's the only way I can make my sister laugh.
Okay.
Is the French voice, because it's exactly how I am when I'm at home. And my family and I, we went to go and see a ballet, and my sister was really cross at me. She wasn't talking to me about something, because she thinks I'm... Because I'm like the big sister and I want to be protective of her. And I'm like, are you eating enough? Make sure you get sleep. And she's like, fuck off. So we go to see the show. And I went, okay, you've got to remember, it's just a play, okay? It's not real. They're ballet dancers. Okay. And I just talked to her the whole time. And she was like, don't talk like that. And we're really loud in the Royal Opera House. And I go, okay, ruler, bend the ruler, fuck. Don't panic, it's pretend. Nobody really gonna die. And she just starts giggling, and it's such a delicious feeling. So I've learned that is my...
It's such a lovely thing. And we saw a flash of it at the end of Chiff Chaff, that moment I spoke to you about when I saw you in the camp yesterday.
Yeah.
When someone was on their phone at the end of the show, and you dealt with them in the most disarmingly playful, funny way, when there was literally 1 minute of the show left and you would have been justified in kicking the phone out of her hand and just said, like, you kind of... It was interesting because you started as you, sort of stepping out of character or stepping out of the show and saying, are you really on your phone? And there was this tension in the audience, like, oh, she's unhappy, she's really unhappy and cross, and this person's done a bad thing, and that reflects badly on us, and, oh, God, there's not much left, and the tension's dangerous. And then you just kind of slip very naturally into that voice, and you finished by saying to her, okay, cheeky, say sorry. And then she went, sorry, and you went, okay. And you moved on, and the moment was completely broken. But that thing of going, cheeky, was completely that voice.
Well, it's nice to give someone the benefit of the doubt, because also nowadays, people are so used to being on their phones. I think viewpoint of what it means to be polite has changed. And there are lots of reasons why you check your phone at the end of a show she might be panicking about. There are lots of reasons why you never know the context.
Of course.
But it's just... And I don't want to step on and be too aggressive. Because, again, it's not just souring her experience. It's souring the whole rooms. So you have to... You're making an example. She came up to me and apologised. She went, I'm really sorry. And I said, yeah, I have to make an example of you. Because you're being rude. You're being naughty. And the rest of the class needs to learn that that's not okay. And that's why I always say... because there was a guy on his phone in Australia, this really good-looking guy sat on the front row, and he was, you know, like your typical good-looking man. He had this beautiful woman sitting next to him, and it turned out they were hot, the whole family, the wife, the mother-in-law, they all come to see the show, and he was on his phone, and I was dressed up as Von Rothbart from Swan Lake, so I've got these giant pool noodles between my legs and my arms, and I'm standing there in a parrot costume with my knickers out, and I looked at him, and I was like, what are you doing? And I started hitting him with the woggles, and I said, is this your wife? And he was like, yes. And I was like, you're sitting next to this beautiful woman watching this amazing show by this amazing performer, and you're on your phone, and one day you're going to be dead? Who are you texting? Who are you even texting? Come on, there's no moment other than now. You've got to apologise. You aren't living the life you want to live. You must be unhappy. You need to put that phone down. You need to go hiking. And I just looked, and I was just like, and I said, you've got to apologise. Apologise to your wife. And he was like, I'm sorry. Apologise to your mother-in-law. And I made him apologise to everyone in the room. And then the next day, I bumped into the mother-in-law and she went, oh, we're so glad that you apologized. You made him apologise, because you know what? We just don't think he appreciates her. And then they were like, and to be honest, she kind of wants to leave him because she thinks he's never present.
But it was
in a kind, I think you have to handle it in a very kind, you've got to treat them like children, because they're big children.
That is, to me, it speaks of a kind of a confidence in you, of your position, your relationship to us. When you say you've got to treat them like children, that suggests such a kind of an authority, like a silly, a really deliciously silly, but nonetheless real authority on your part.
Well, the audience are a really rare bird. They're very vulnerable. You're only going to get that group of people once. And their emotional stability, you know, their emotional environment, that's only existing that one time. You have no idea what they're like when they come into the room. So you've got to be very gentle, I think. That's my opinion with an audience. And if I'm preparing for a show, it's a bit like you revise for an exam. And this might sound a bit, shows sort of the focus on academia that we had as children, but you revise for the exam, you revise as much as you can. But at the end of the day, you don't know what question you're going to get, but you answer the question that you're given. You don't answer the question you want to answer. You don't just write everything you know about Iago from Othello. You write about what they give you. And so when I come on and I look at the audience, I think, what have I been given? Who are you? What... Because last night I looked at the audience for... So the night I think you came to see Chifchaff, it was quite a young audience. And based on the assumptions of looking at the audience, I thought, OK, I'm not sure many of you are necessarily economic theorists. You might be up for something a bit rude. I mean, I'm making generalisations, but you sort of work out what they laugh at and what they giggle at. And last night the audience was pretty much everyone's granddad.
Yeah.
And they were a lot older, and they'd clearly come because they'd seen Mervyn Stutter's Pick of the Fringe.
It's the kiss of Stutter. Yeah, that brilliant showcase, and then the next night it's all silver tops.
It's all silver tops, and they were all very lovely silver tops. Everyone's in Bowdoin, and they were all like, look at this young lady doing something brave. Wow, look at her. She's coming out on stage, and she's doing a show about the economy. It's at 6:50. We'll have dinner afterward. How wonderful. And I came out on stage, and I give these two men sex dolls, and I go, right, I need you to blow this up. And I had to start a bit more authoritative and make sure that they know I know what I'm doing.
Yes.
And then get them on board with going, now we can all be really silly.
Yes.
And it's a bit like having sex. You know the first time you have sex with someone and you're a bit like, right, okay, what does this work? Does this work? Do you like that? No. And then you get into the thrill of it. It's a bit like at the beginning, it's the foreplay going, ooh, do you like that? Oh, no. Okay. Ooh. Okay, this is how you like it. Okay, full steam. But you don't want to do it too quick. You've got to, like, take your time. And that's probably a terrible way of describing it, but...
No, I think it's the only way of describing it. I think it's I'm forever saying this on the show, it's a sensual art. Someone told me that about acting, and I've nicked it and adopted it. It is, comedy is a sensual art. That's one of the reasons why reviewers don't work, because why reviewers, it doesn't make any sense, because if you're having sex with someone and they're reviewing you, they're making notes, then it's not the thing.
Yeah, I would say, put your notepad down.
Put your notepad down, let's fuck.
Yeah,
there
was a reviewer last year, I gave her a prop for Swan, she went, I'm really sorry, I'm reviewing. And I was like, well, how can you review the show if you're not a part of it?
Yeah.
I said, put your notepad down and just have this, and all I need you to do is blow bubbles. I mean, people are going to love you, people are going to hate you, it doesn't matter. Exactly. It really doesn't matter. I think the best compliment I got was when I got called an ordeal by the Times.
Oh, God, that was so funny. You taking ownership of that at the beginning of the show was... Mwah. An ordeal is such...
Do you know what's funny about that? Is I couldn't read that review because it's behind a paywall. So I've never read what Dominic Maxwell really thinks of me. But I think it's the sign of a good show when you can have lovely, when you have all these different reactions. Because if you have an audience just sit there going, I understand this, it's not stimulating. It's just missionary.
So this is Elf. As you can hear, what a joy to talk to her. Jake Crossland, who kindly logged this episode for me, sent an email back going, I've got nothing to... I normally ask my loggers to embolden things of particular interest. And he said, I couldn't put any of this in bold because I loved all of it. And I'm the same. You can hear how much I'm enjoying chatting to Elf. Such an intellect combined with such a kind of an extraordinary sort of creative, sensual approach to clowning. And I mean that in the sense of when intellect is married with, when comic intellect is married with a kind of a really visceral comic sensibility for what's funny, that really gets my thing happening. So I urge you to go and see Elf in whatever form you can. And this chordoquina that she's suffering from, I don't know anything about it at all apart from what she's very briefly told me. It sounds like it could have a long-term effect on her work. So I reiterate, big love to Elf, and I really hope that she is able to continue making the work that she's so brilliant at making. We'll get back into this interview in just a second. A couple of messages. First, we had a message on the Facebook group, which has been really good fun recently. It remains an extremely pleasant and friendly corner of the internet and is full of people who listen to this podcast, kindred spirits, other people who are excited about nerdy comedy things. I keep saying that. I keep referring to the listenership as kind of comedy nerds or mega nerds. I don't mean anything negative by that. I consider myself a comedy nerd, just someone who is really excited about the precepts of this show. So forgive me. Let me know if me calling you all comedy nerds frustrates you. Because there's got to be a better term for that. There's comrades and companions and so forth. That's all doable. Feels a little bit done. Anyway. The point being, in the Facebook group, there are lots of really interesting conversations happening at the moment about mid-career pivots with reference to James Acaster and how he appears to have gone even deeper and got even better by making his work more personal. I believe his West End show, Cold Lasagna, Hate Myself 1999, is still happening in the West End, so do go along and see that. Another thing, so this is the whole reason I mentioned this, in the Facebook group, I got a message from someone saying quite a few of the comics on the Philly scene, I assume that means Philadelphia in a cool American way, she got into the podcast because quite a few of the comics on the Philly scene listened to them. That's nice. And hello to you, and hello to all comics on the Philly scene. Get in touch. Get in touch if you're enjoying this podcast and you feel that it features in whatever scene that you're in outside of the UK. I know lots of UK listeners enjoy it, but if you are part of a comedy scene somewhere and you think, oh, this podcast is getting handed around, I'd love to know. How exciting. So thanks to her and all scene members. What else was I going to mention? Oh, yes, Brett Goldstein's podcast, Films to be Buried With. I'm on episode 17, the current episode, and it's, so much fun. If you like the things I like, specifically time loop movies, heists and Moana, you're really going to enjoy that. I had such a fun conversation with Brett, and I think his podcast is excellent. It's one of those ones that's so good and he's so great that I don't mind advertising it to you despite feeling a bit threatened by it because it's so good. See what I mean? What's the word? The Germans have probably got a word for that. There's something about Brett, who's a fabulous comedian and film star, who is too afraid to come on this podcast because, listen to the episode and you'll find out exactly why he's too scared to come on ComCom. But he is a ComCompletist. He's listened to every one of these. So for that reason alone, we should definitely give his show a try. And also because his voice contains a sort of inherent smile, which is... I can't listen to Brett's voice without breaking into a grin. So you can do that for an entire hour about heists and time loop by finding films to be buried with. I was going to say something else. So the Facebook group. Yes, there's some Frank Skinner work in progress dates mentioned in the Facebook group, but that's probably sold out by now. Sozzers. Who says sozzers? You know when you say something ironically for long enough that you just say it? Oh, it's terrible, isn't it? And thank you to a listener called David who emailed me. It simply said, the subject line was Future Girl, and the whole text was, mine is six, mate. Welcome to the jungle. Thanks, David, and thanks everyone that's been getting in touch with lovely messages, positive messages, about my beautiful daughter. It was very exciting. In the Facebook group, I posted a picture of me and her, about 2 days old, and it received an overwhelming amount of social media engagement, which is, you know, normally the Facebook group is like people jump on stuff and get excited, but this was like, oh, wow. I mean, that's the only picture you're ever going to get of her, so please enjoy that. Join up the Facebook group by searching for it on, you know, that platform. So that's all of the gubbins. My tour is still on sale. I've added a few dates. Cheltenham is now on sale. Salisbury's on sale. Mostly places in the southwest, south and west of England at the moment. Crawley, and I don't have them in front of me, but, you know, the usual places I go to, plus some new ones. Falmouth. Who goes to Falmouth? I'm going to find out. So you can find all of that stuff on the tour at comedianscomedian.com/tour. And do, you know, the shows tend to sell well. They're small venues and they sell a modest, decent amount of tickets. But what's good about getting in early is that should it suddenly go nuts, you're safe. And also it lets me relax and go, oh, good, I'm going to Falmouth and some people are going to be there. So if you fancy that, even though it's not for months, get it in the diary now. I took my son to an amazing eye-popping and ear-exploding show called Lo-Fi Funky Space Quest. And that was at the Wardrobe Theatre in Bristol. I had loads of fun seeing that. And that was only because I had seen a flyer months earlier, booked it in and went, right, I'm seeing it on that day. And it all worked out. Having a child is definitely forcing me to live in a much more organised way. More on that perhaps in the postamble, or maybe we'll make it less wanging on about your kid-based. That's everything for now. I feel like there's something else to tell you about, but there we are. We'll discuss it later after the conclusion of this conversation with Elf Lyons.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
The show last night with the Silver Tops in Bowdoin,
yeah.
I wanted to pick on a particular thing you said, which is that you were talking about you need to convince them that you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Now, one of the elements of you on stage, one of the notes that you play, is a kind of chaotic note. It's the illusion of not knowing what you're doing.
Yeah.
You're not apologising for the show, but part of that kind of clown energy of, like, looking at us, letting us in and just breathing out, like, oh, Christ, what now? That kind of quality.
Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about how you transmit that you don't know what you're doing whilst also transmitting that it's okay because you know what you're doing about not knowing what you're doing.
The truth is, I don't really know what I like. So all I know is, right, this bit, I eat a banana. I don't know, fiscal policy. I like to explain fiscal policy. Next bit, what I'd like to do is, because I'm not a joke writer, I don't write jokes. I've never been good at writing jokes. I feel like the words don't really matter. That's my opinion. I feel like words mean very little. It's how you say something that's funny. So I give myself a challenge. I go, right, I'm going to be really sexy now. And what's the limitation? Okay. So I'm dressed in a parrot costume and I'm going to be really sexy. How am I going to be really sexy? Right, Shawn Michaels from WWF Wrestling. Right, I'm going to do it to that. I need to explain ballet. But that can be quite boring if you get really good at knowing what ballet is. So how do I limit that? Do it in French. Don't speak French. Okay, I'll learn French. If I can't remember French, I'll make up words. You give yourself these sort of...
And is that Gaulier or is that you?
I think that's me. That's not necessarily... like you learn different exercises from Gaulier. But again, I didn't learn clown. I did all the theatre-y stuff. Mm-hmm. I was trying to learn how to be a woman, I feel like, at Gaulier. Learning how to be in my shape and in my body and owning myself as a creature. So it's funny, because I feel like I do clown, though I didn't study it with Gollier.
I agree, yes.
The inherent point of clown for me is that it's child, it's pure, and it's joyful, and it's present. You're with the audience, and you're not trying to make a political point. That the moment you're trying to make a political point, make the audience think about something, it's not clown. And also, the moment you try and force a meaning on something, the meaning halves. The audience get more meaning out of something when you just say it, when you it's just pure.
Can you... I wouldn't ask you to sort of point to that. I think that's interesting. If you try and force a meaning, the meaning halves. I wouldn't ask you to point to that in someone else's work, but are there bits of work you've made in the past where you were trying to force a meaning?
Yeah, I mean, when I did Pelican, which was the show I did before Swan, and I was very depressed making Pelican. I wanted to do a show about my relationship with my mum, and the truth was I wasn't ready to do a show about my relationship with my mum. My relationship with my mum is very good, but my parents are very... My upbringing, I've only on reflection, was so unlike a lot of people's upbringings, I think. Very... My parents live life of... with an undefended heart, and everything was very, like, you saw all the bruises, you saw everything. And me, my brother and sister, and I were very much, we saw everything that was going on. And I think it really, my viewpoint of what a relationship with your mother and father is actually very different to what a lot of people's relationship is. And I was trying to make a show about that, but I fully wasn't really aware of that. At the same time, I had a miscarriage, and I was trying to put that in the show because I was trying to make... Because the thing that was important to me at the time was not enough people talk about miscarriage, and it's incredibly common, and a lot of people have them. And mine was slightly bizarre because I was on birth control at the time, so I shouldn't have been able to have one anyway. It was all a bit out of nowhere. And I was trying to put that in the show, and I think actually at the time I was trying to make a meaningful, you know, the 45-minute in, you have the point show, but also in a weird way, because my mum's alive, I don't feel like I could go full hog on my mum, and I don't mean that in a disrespectful way, but really difficult to do a very honest show about someone who's in the audience. And I think that was the reason I decided to do Swan, because I came away from doing Pelican so sad and so broken. And my partner at the time, John Luke Roberts, he said to me, "When you really stay away from doing personal stuff for a while, just be silly." And I went, right, well, I'm just going to do Swan Leg. I'm going to do Swan. And that was it. And then Swan, for me, felt like me being my most vulnerable, because it was me at my most happy, being silly. And that was why I got really... When people said it didn't have any point to it, and I was like, that is the point, though, because to be silly is still so rebellious. And we don't allow people that opportunity enough. And what was really lovely about doing Swan was the amount of women who came up to me and said they found it really inspiring to watch another woman be so stupid.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really, like, nice.
Is it more of an act of rebellion to be silly, given that you're a woman?
Possibly. Yeah, well, I remember doing Swan at Soho Theatre, and someone came up to me and I found it so bizarre that you had your knickers out. I just couldn't believe... the amount of men performers that you see with the penises out, or, you know, very tight shorts, and the joke being you can see their genitals. I've got knickers on. It's not like you can see the contours of my labia. You can just see that I've got knickers on, and for some reason that's...
Yeah, it is. Well, it's... Yeah.
And it's almost... I find in the parrot costume, it was that refusal to accept that I'm a sexual creature, because the parrot costume is so unsexy. And I'm walking around with my big legs out, jumping around like a big bloody buffalo in French.
So when you came to... Coming back to this idea of limitations, mm-hmm. you have an idea for a thing. Let's talk a little bit more about that process. In terms of making your most recent show, which you said you made under pressure, you had 2 months to make it in, and what was the very first starting point? Is it that I want to do something about the economy?
Yep.
Or is it I want to do something impossible? Oh, I couldn't possibly do something about the economy. That'll do.
Yeah. So I don't know anything. I know the economy because my dad knows the economy, but I know the economy in the way I know the economy. But I couldn't debate with someone about the economy necessarily who's academic, who's good at arguing, because that's when I get flustered. I'm not very good at arguments, never have been. It's why I'm not good with hecklers. I'm better at being kind, I think. I've worked out my own way of dealing with aggression, partly also, I think, probably from childhood, like watching people interact. I'm like, I can't get into this. So I thought, right, do economics. It'll annoy my dad. How can I do it? What am I not good at? I can't do musical comedy. I've never done it. I'd like to give it a go. I'll do musical comedy. I love doing mime. I'm not very good at mime, but I really want to do mime. I'll do mime. Put that in. I love drag. I love lip syncing. I love the cabaret world. I really want to incorporate that. So I'll put drag into it. I'll put cabaret lip syncing into it. I'll interview my dad. And I always thought I'll put that in. And then at the same time, I've always wanted to be good at hula hooping. I want to be more better with my body because it is. I'm so dyspraxic and physically I don't really know what I'm doing with it. And Aitor from Spy Monkey said the funniest thing about you is how stupid you are with your body and you don't even realise it. He said the things that you do without, like, when I'm flustered, I just walk in a circle. These really silly things I didn't realise I do. So I put myself in this impossible scenario. So how do you teach fiscal policy with two sex dolls? How do you... And what makes me happy explaining it? And for me, it made complete sense to dress up as a lion and do the Lion King. It might.
What do you mean, for me, it made sense to do that?
It just made complete sense for me that... How would I explain the economy? Well, the economy lives in all of us. We are the market. The market controls me. My dad is an economist, and I'm little, and I would like to be an economist, but I'm trying to... I've got these big footsteps to fill, and people don't realise the economy is beautiful, and it's really empowering. And then I naturally think of the Lion King, and then I think of It Lives in You, and I was like, well, that makes sense, and I'll give birth to the earth. I think it shouldn't be difficult. Philippe would always say this at school sometimes. They go, oh, don't kick me off, Philippe. I tried really hard. And you go, well, you tried hard. You shouldn't have tried hard. It should be easy. I think, yeah, when you come across a good idea, and I don't mean it should just come straight away, but there's almost that simple, it's falling in love, isn't it? It's not hard to be in a relationship. You argue, but it's easy to say sorry. It's easy to get back on track. And I think that's what a good idea is. And if I have to work too hard on something, so it's why I took the prisoner's dilemma out. I realised... The joke is, I do know the prisoner's dilemma. I pretend I get confused. Yes. And the audience have to jump in and help me. But too many people think that I genuinely don't know the prisoner's dilemma. And I went, it's funny for me and it's funny for people who know me. But if it's not funny enough, I've got to take it out.
Yes.
And I'm not having enough fun. So I put another mime in and I do a bit where I recreate The Shining.
Are you able to... Given that you're in the thick of the festival now, we've done the first weekend, you've identified this bit actually is repeatedly not working. With your model of working, whereby a stand-up, for example, if a stand-up were to bin 5 minutes of stuff, you'd need to write a pretty quick... that would be hard to write 5 minutes of ready stuff. Are you in a situation where you go, this is easy, it's like falling in love, I'll just have another silly idea that limits me, that challenges me, I'll think of another thing, yeah, I can't do, and I'll try and do that?
Pretty much.
So you are able to go, well, I'll fill this in with a five-minute game, which
not
is
always, like,
an impossible challenge.
It's not obviously that simple, because it has to also be relative, and it can't just be, you can't just be picking something surrealist for surrealist's sake, because, you know, you watch shows and you feel that bit comes out of nowhere, and it's not worth... It still has to have a cohesive impact. But I took Prisoner's Dilemma out and I looked at what I already had. And I realised with the mimes, I can stretch them out. And also basic in human interaction, interacting with the audience. And I don't like thinking about things in terms of 5 minutes or 4 minutes. It's as long as it needs to be for it to be funny. So if it's 1 minute and it's not working, I'll take that 1 minute out. If it's a 1 minute and it's really good, I'll keep it. I can't think about it in terms of time. It makes me really anxious. When I teach sometimes on a lecture occasionally about how to make theatre work, and the way I always imagine it, I think the way anyone should make a show is you imagine you've been given an unlimited budget. And I say you've got any venue you want, any sound team, you've got everyone, you've got everything you've ever wanted to do it. So I just want you to come up with that dream show and there's no limitation. So you want Elton John in it, Elton John's in it. Da, 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 da. And you make the show and you've got to think about, it's not just the script, it's the music, it's the stage lighting, pyrotechnics. It's the audience, who's the audience demographic. How are they laid out? You think about all these aspects. And then after you've planned it and you've budgeted it, I go, I'm really sorry, I got the budget wrong. It's $500,000. And then you do $500,000. So you just cut it down a little bit. Maybe it's not Elton John, okay, it's Taylor Swift or whatever. Maybe not Taylor. And like, I'm really sorry, I got that wrong. It's £1,000. And then it's £1,000. And you go, how do I do it with £1,000? You go, okay, I'll get someone with an Elton John mask to do it. I'll lip sync Elton John. I need them in the round. I can't do it in the opera house, so I'll tell people we're in the opera house. And you restrict it and you restrict it until I say, you've got 10 quid and you've got the room you're in. How do you put this show on? And then it's that simple. It's like that thing in Shakespeare, isn't it? When Puck goes, I'm invisible. That's all you need. Yeah, just tell the audience, I'm invisible. Done. Yeah. It doesn't need to be uber complicated. And it's kind of like what Stephen King says on writing. There's this beautiful bit. Have you read it?
I have. I love it.
Oh, God.
I love it. I walked past it in a bookshop and I went, oh, it's been a good 5 years since I've read
that.
Oh,
it's just beautiful. But there's this lovely bit in it. He talks about trusting in the audience or the reader. And there's this bit, he says, there is a table. On the table, there is a white tablecloth. In the centre of the table, there is a cage. In the cage, there is a white rabbit. And on the rabbit, in red, is the number 9 or something like that. And then he says, I don't specify what type of table it is, whether it's an iron table or wooden table. I don't specify whether the tablecloth's made out of ivory or lace. I don't specify what type of cage it is, whether it's perspex or, you know, wood. I don't specify what type of rabbit it is, but you've done all that work already.
Yeah.
And because of that, it gives you a more powerful image because you pick all the rest yourself. I feel like that's a really good thing with comedy. You don't need to give the audience everything because they'll work it. They'll fill in the gaps. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
God, I feel like I sound like a real wanker.
No, I love it. I love it. I'm getting quiet in the way that I get quiet, but I'm just going, oh, I love it. And a Stephen King analogy. Oh, the best. I'm struck by how I work the opposite way around to that. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated by it because I think, I've got nothing. What can I possibly do?
Yeah.
You know, and I wonder if that's to my artistic detriment to kind of... I always love seeing shows where people massively overreach themselves. You know, when I heard, Elfie's doing a musical about the economy, I was like, of course she is. You know, it's like a completely impossible thing.
You've got to, because why wouldn't you do something impossible? Like, why wouldn't you? Like, I don't... When someone says, oh, I'm going to just do a show about my year at home. Why? Does that make you, like, get wrecked with excitement? Like, is that what is really turning
Well, I suppose for me, I like the idea of making something from nothing.
Yeah.
I like the idea. I like the challenge of going, it's just me and a microphone and all I'm going to do is talk.
Yeah.
But my ideas are going to be so... not clever, but like they're going to be artfully or deftly relatable. I'm going to reveal a truth you knew, but you didn't know you knew it. You know, it's about ideas rather than play. And I suppose what I try and do is go, here is an idea, and now I'm going to play within the idea.
Yeah.
Like that's,
see, I
that's
couldn't
what it is
do that. Like, that's such a different way of
I feel like I've stood up for my own stuff for once. I never do that.
No, great. Because it's just the way you each work, isn't it? It's why stand-up and comedy is so beautiful, because there are all these different bits of it. Like, I couldn't do what you do. Like, I'm not good at... That thing doesn't excite... It doesn't... Not that I love watching it,
sure.
But I can't... I try and think like that, and that was the problem I had with Pelican. I was trying to make a straight stand-up show, and it was received well. People really reacted to it. There were lots of funny bits in it. It was a good show, but it wasn't... Every time I was getting into it, I wasn't going, oh, God, I can't wait to get on stage and do this bit of material in my sexy pre-comedy voice. I was going, oh, right, I've got to hit that beat. I've got to make sure that joke's in there, otherwise I can't do that callback. Oh, remember, if I don't mention that bit, then the theory of the show doesn't add up. For me, it was writing a boring essay.
Yeah.
And I think it's more exciting... I talk about it in the show, you know, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. I always think it's far more exciting to think, I want to make lemonade, but I've not got any lemons. How do you do it? I think that theatre, that process is really fun.
Does it... Is there also, for all the sort of risk and excitement of biting off more than you can chew on purpose, is there a kind of a safety to attempting the impossible? Because if you fail, well, look, it was impossible anyway.
Possibly. But at the same time, the job is to make people laugh, isn't it? Like, that is the main goal. As long as I'm hitting that, as long as the audience are laughing, I've succeeded. For me. It depends on what your objective is. Like, my objective as Chief Chatter is to show that economics is beautiful. I think I do that. I fully believe I make people realise that economics is beautiful. The same way I think people... I really do believe that I tell the story of Swan Lake. I do. And I think that's possibly why people think it's a clown show, because people go, you don't. It's so stupid. But I will argue.
No, I go, no.
I don't think I could have explained Swan Lake in a more clear and inclusive way than taking my knickers off at the end and covering myself in ketchup and shouting, I am woman. I feel like that is the only way you can explain Swan Lake. But I don't know.
Do you think that you have been afforded the opportunity to take risks because you have less of a financial imperative because of class, say?
Yeah. I wonder. It's an interesting... Because I was brought up... Let me think. I want to try and vocalise this in the correct way, because obviously I'm very lucky in that my mum and dad, when I said I wanted to be a comedian when I was 16, said, OK, you become a comedian. And I said I wanted to do it. And they said, well, don't go to university, focus on being a comedian. We'll drive you to comedy gigs. If that's what you want to do, you do it and you fuck. But the rule is in my family, if you want to do something, you don't just half do it, you do it. Like, my sister, when she wanted to be a horse rider, and she competed professionally, and then she had an accident. But, I mean, it was intense, and she left school, and she was homeschooled so she could be a horse rider. There was no, you know, it wasn't just like, oh, getting on your pony at the weekend. No, it was her whole life. And for comedy, that was exactly how my mum and dad focused it on with me. And so there was such a responsibility. And it was like last year when I got nominated, and in a very jokey way, like, our family rinse each other all the time. Like, we constantly rinse each other. Like, my dad read me the Times Review down the phone when he got it, and they...
Because he's got the paywall.
Yeah, he's got the paywall. But, like, the moment, if I post up a good review on the family chat, my siblings will immediately post one of the bad reviews, just so... But, like, I said, oh, I got nominated. And it was really nice to say that, because I knew that would make my parents proud. But then my dad was like, well, you didn't win. Come on. You didn't win. So get off your high horse. You've got to make something else.
Is there an element, just trying to get a view of your relationship with your family, is there like a grain of truth in that? Or is it entirely they love you, so they're winding you up?
Oh, they love me, but it's true. I mean, it's like it is. We've got to do good. I think it's why I'm okay with failure, because I've failed it in so many different ways. But it's like the only thing I think about and put first in anything is my job. So I'm trying to think of how to formulate this. So I want to be a comedian, so I did every unpaid internship I did every job. I was very lucky that I was able to. Like, when I got a job, I was working as a cocktail waitress in a cocktail bar, and my dad was really angry. He said, why are you doing that? Because you're too exhausted and you're not able to focus on comedy. And I was like, well, I really need to show that I can do other things. He went, no, just focus on what you're good at, because your dad had to do loads of different jobs before he was able to become the economist he is. He's like, I didn't work hard so you could get tired and not do what you wanted to do. And then I did all these different jobs. I managed to do all the... I did drama at university. I was totally ingrained in it. My first solo show, first one, 40 minutes, Elf Lines is a Pervert. That was straight stand-up. Did that at the Brighton Fringe. My dad saw it, and he was like, that needs to be better. I was like, it does. And then I did Underground Success, which was sort of a one-up on that, and that was about the Tube, and that was, again, straight stand-up. And I was sort of getting in touch with my nicheness and, like, my eccentricities, as it were. But it wasn't good enough. And then I did Being Barbarella, and then that got crowdfunded.
Good enough for you, or good enough for him?
I think just good enough in general. I don't know. But my family were so involved in each other's life. And then Being Barbarella, I got crowdfunded to go to Australia. So I managed to fund that to get to Australia. And Australia, for me, was the game changer, because I was out there on my own. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have anyone watching me. I didn't have anyone on my back. And I also didn't have an agent. I didn't have anyone to... I just finished my master's. It was the first time I was kind of free to go, fuck it, I'll do what I want. And I got good at comedy, I feel like. I don't want to sound that in a boastful way, but I got as good as I could be at that point for me. And I really had fun. And I came back and I did Edinburgh. And that was when I decided to do Gollier. I mean, I'm very lucky that I managed to obviously, I did lots of different jobs so I could financially afford to go to Goliath. But I think the crucial thing was I've always had that family support to do comedy. I've never been... Yeah, they've like occasionally my mum's like, well, why don't you do something else? Because it makes you depressed. Why don't you become a teacher or do something else? And I go, well, risk versus reward. You know, the comedy's the only thing I could imagine. It's the only thing I... Like, a partner once said to me, he went, I didn't realise that you put comedy before anything else. Like, I was like, well, yeah, I do, because it's like, I've had it all the time. It sounds really depressing. I don't know. I'm trying to formulate what I mean. I mean, class definitely must be in there. Obviously, like, I went to an all-girls boarding school where I never had the limitations of men telling me I couldn't do something. I always defined myself as a woman who was funny, who could do comedy. We were told we could do anything we wanted to do at my school. She said, it doesn't matter if you're bad at maths, but if you're good at drama, you do drama. I had a really fantastic headmistress. I had a really great education. I had some horrible things happen as well, but which I think, I mean... There was one cool thing. I'm not sure if this is interesting. I'm not sure if this is entirely related. But, like, I feel like I'm a really sexual person on stage as a persona. And I've only recently really got that. Because I had a horrible experience when I was a teenager. And I remember when I had to deal with it, the doctor, the GP at the time, was just like, well, it was your fault, you were asking for it, da-da-da-da-da. All that horrible, you know, unfortunately, that lots of people do face. And I went to university, I think, dealing with that grief and that belief that it was my fault. And then I was performing this really sexually confident girl. I'm such a cool girl. Whoa, whoa, whoa. And actually, inside, I was very broken and very little and just wanted to be cuddled. And then I went to Goliath, and Philippe really picked up on that, I think. He said, you have this real desire to be loved. You really are desperate to be loved. But actually, we can't love you when you're desperate to be loved. You just need to come on stage and go... fuck it, I love myself. You've got to be a bitch. And so one day I came on stage, and this was in Buffon, and I performed as this GP, this doctor, and I said verbatim what she'd said to me when I was 17, and I performed it as her. And he was like, that is Buffon, and that is fucking good. That is Buffon, that is good. And I felt really like, I was like, I own myself. And that led me on to when I went and did Swan and did I'm totally in charge of my personality. I'm not sure, I don't know, it's really weird talking about it so much because you don't want to sound too wanky, do you? But I feel that's why only in recent years, especially through being at Goliath, I feel like a woman and a person. And it's why I take real pride in being a sexually confident creature on stage and playing with those gender identities of being very silly, very goofy, very innocent, and then very, like, womanly. Because I've been through, like a lot of people, been through the ringer of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I'm wrapped. As they say. Absolutely. I think just to go into that thing, Buffon, I understand to mean a kind of dark clown, a sort of sneering, I don't know quite how else to describe it. Sort of a clown that laughs at misfortune.
Well, it's not entirely... it depends on the way different people have been taught it, doesn't it? The same way people have been taught about clown, because Philippe would say Dr. Brown. Phil is not a clown. He goes, yeah, Phil is not a clown. But Phil is a clown, but he's a different type of clown to...
Sure.
You know, they're all different styles, but... And Philippe would probably not think I was a clown because I'm sexual, and he doesn't like it when women are sexual for clowns. Which, again, I disagree with.
Yeah, sure.
That Buffon is, in traditional medieval times, if you were a heretic, if you were gay, if you were disabled, if you had Down syndrome, or whatever, if you were a slut, if you'd been raped, if you were a polluted woman, you were sent out to live in the swamps. You were kicked out of the town. You weren't allowed to be a part of the town. And there was one day of the year where you'd be allowed back into town to blaspheme against God. And you were allowed to put on a play, and that was called the Play of the Buffons. And the objective of the play is to perform it to the king, and the king goes... You do an impression of the king. The disabled man does an impression of the king, and the king goes, that's not impressing me. And the guy's like, yes, I'm the king. And the king goes, that's not me. And the king goes, no. And the Buffon goes, no, I am the king. And the king laughs and then realises that that is who he is, and he dies. It's... You know, I suppose spitting image, you could say, is some sort of origination from Buffon.
Yeah, 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 okay.
Caricatures. It's like you're doing a bastards. Yeah. And Philippe, when we did it at school, he'd always say, a bouffon, you've got to pick a bastard. And the bastard is someone who would hand you over to the Gestapo.
Yeah.
That's a bastard. So it's not just someone who you didn't like. It's someone who's a real bastard. And that, yeah.
And so when you had that, what sounds like a very key moment in your ownership of yourself, yeah. your comedy self and your actual, you know, your real yeah. self, what was it about that, performing that verbatim, what the GP had said to you, what was it about that allowed you to take ownership?
I think it was that complete, I didn't have any shame in it, and also I was being a bitch. I went on stage and also I enjoyed playing her. So the monologue is, I came on dressed as this character and I sat down and I went, so I've spoken to the doctor and I think it's best we keep this between ourselves. No point telling your mum and dad about this. I hear you're going to Bristol. 3 A's, is it? Clever girl. No use crying over spilled milk. At the end of the day, you were naked and in bed. It was your fault. You were asking for it. Anyway, run over. You're a prefect. Now you've got to take these things seriously. I hear you want to be a comedian. How brave. I hope you don't put me in one of your comedy routines. And that was how she ended it. And I came on stage and I sat there really still and I performed it and I really enjoyed it. I fucking enjoyed saying it because it was like a real taking those words back and the audience and also relishing in the reaction of the audience going, oh, no, shit, really? And it was like, it was a sucker punch. And I'm going, yeah, but you know what? It's okay because I'm doing it. And I think that's what it is. And Philippe was like, that was really good. And I was really proud of that. And, yeah, I mean, if I'd come on stage and... Because also, and during Bouffon, we dealt a lot with sexual abuse and we dealt a lot with rape in the course because a lot of girls did... We all started coming forward and talking about these things. And there were people who hadn't made peace with it and who were coming on stage and just suddenly bursting into tears. And Philippe would go, we can't do this.
Yeah.
Because you've not... And Philippe,
good.
When I...
Good.
When I,
it's yeah. good to hear. I mean, this is obviously yeah, yeah. such sensitive yeah. stuff. I'm glad
Philippe,
that
when I performed,
there is a break on it.
Because I performed it and Philippe really interrogated me in front of the whole school. He was like, when was this? And he wanted to make sure I wasn't going to film it. Because if I had started crying, he would have gone, no, this doesn't go in the show.
Yeah.
Because you have to always be playful. You can't be sad. And it's really important when I do comedy... For all the sadness that I've got, if, you know, we all suffer with our own bits and pieces, whatever's going on, I go on stage and I'm so happy to be with that audience. Like, I have to, because it's the only time I get to really be happy.
So would you be able sometime in the future to revisit the themes of Pelican
yeah.
from a point of view of having made peace with it
yeah.
and find that... I don't know the yeah. terms of it. I never saw the show, I'm afraid, and I don't know the nature of your relationship with your mother. You've alluded, I think, to a couple of things about your family having quite...
It's very Wes Anderson-esque. I think that's the safest way of describing it. It's yeah. really Wes okay. Anderson. Like, my mum and dad are just... Like, when we were little, it was... And it's funny, because I can't not make them be a part of my comedy, because my family are integral to everything. And I think it's also from having been separated with them, going to boarding school,
sure.
having that... this very different bond. And I'm so... They're so supportive and they give so much unconditional love. But it's also a very powerful love that accidentally sometimes... It's a bit like being cuddled by a vampire who doesn't realise how strong they are. Or, you know, like a really big dog. And you're like, oh, you're a bit powerful. Oh, you're bruising me a bit. That's the... They're naturally... They always are there in my shows. Even when I... Like, on the way here, I thought, I'm not going to talk about my parents. But they naturally are. Part of it, because they're just so ingrained in creating the comedy and encouraging me and my sister and brother to do what we wanted to do. Like, my mum and dad, when we were little, we'd all just sleep in the same bed. We'd watch films throughout the night. My mum would say, don't go to school. When I'd get my school report, she'd throw it at the back of the car, we wouldn't read it. And then at the same time, my mum is very emotional, they're very artistic. She's an artist and she's very emotional. My dad's a very emotional person. You saw all these signs of them. And I always escorted... When my dad's mates died, I'd always come with my dad to funerals because I'm quite good with people in grief. And my dad would always wear sunglasses in churches. And I'd go, Dad, take your sunglasses off. You look like a member of the Bloody Blues Brothers. He'd be like, no, because he doesn't want to show his emotion. Like, all these really funny, silly little things. And I don't know, it just... I don't know what I'm talking about. Sorry, Stu, I've gone off on one.
No, this is good.
I'm daydreaming. I'm dreaming.
It's all good gear. It's all good stuff, because I'm interested in... It does sound like you have a very unusual family background. And it sounds like... For me, I suppose, a confusing element of it is that you... Like, you throw the school report in the back of the car, that kind of mum, who nonetheless sent you to boarding school, which to me sounds like a very authoritarian thing to do.
The truth is, the reason I went to boarding school was I couldn't get into grammar schools. My mum and dad wanted me to go, because they both went to grammar schools, and they both... They didn't... You know, they wanted me to go with everyone else, but I was dyslexic, I was dyspraxic, and I was weird. I didn't fit in. I read loads of books on my own. I used to spend weeks with my nanny Squeak and my granddad Squeak. I didn't go to school. I'd go and see plays at the Bob Hope Theatre. You know, I did one-woman productions of Beckett being stabbed in Canterbury Cathedral. And I did loads of, you know...
And how much of a weirdo do you now feel? Do you feel like you fit into the world, or do you feel like you are a weirdo on your own terms? Or, you know, you spoke before in the bit that we've lost... about not feeling like you were a proper person.
Yeah, I didn't feel like I was a proper
person. What about now?
Yeah, I'm a person. But also, I'm lucky because I don't drink anymore. I'm sober. I'm doing a show I love. Well, I'm doing a show that I know I will love. I've got really great friends in comedy, and I love comedy, and I love what I do. And all I've ever done is focus on doing what I love. And I'm very lucky to be doing that.
If there are people listening to this, as I'm sure there will be, who identify as weirdos, who are yet to feel like themselves or yet to feel like they fit into the world, besides the advice of find the comedy circuit, meet a load of other weirdos, you know, because often that feels... I'm sure people listening to this might feel like that's the only way they can feel like themselves, is if they join the fucking circus, the cavalcade of peculiar people. Without reference to comedy... What things could you say to someone, could you say to young Elf about how they might fit into the world or how they might feel more like a proper person?
Just style it out. Fuck them. My dad would always say they're all a bunch of fucking wankers. And my dad did this thing and it was so sweet because I always remember, I remember once when I was a child going out for dinner with my dad and going, Dad, I'd really like to get to know you. Which, in hindsight, it's such a weird thing to say as a 10-year-old to your father, going, I would really like to get to know you. And my dad came in like a few years back and he just handed me this document. And I opened the first page and it was said from like 1990... It's weird not to get emotional. It said from 1997, it was like, Dear Emily Ann, I'm on a plane flying to Singapore. I'm going to work. But I thought I'd like to write about some of the things you've achieved and show you that I'm very emotional. I'm very, very proud of you, even though I don't say it. And then there was one page which it was in it. And it was... And I remember this so well, these kids. And it was this play day. And I wanted to go and play with them, and they didn't want to play with me. And I remember, oh God, it's so funny to get so emotional about something so long ago. And I remember, like, the thing, they all turned and they ran the other way. And I was like, oh, that's annoying. And I sort of went, oh, it's okay, I'll go on the Ferris wheel on my own. So I went straight, because I was sort of, you style it out. And my dad had written you, and I saw those girls turn and ignore you, and I knew how upset you were, but you were so brave, and I'm so proud of you, and they're all a bunch of fucking wankers. And he'd written that, and he handed that to me years later, and I was like, oh, like he did, he, you know, they were very aware. I don't know what I'm trying to say. But they're very, I mean, for as mental as they both are, they're like, I couldn't, they're integral to my comedy. And it's so funny, like, they ring me up, they'll be very critical. My dad came and saw Chiff Chaff and he fucking hated it. And he gave
his
economics is important to him, and it was a very bad preview. It's Cambridge, sure. I was very nervous. He was on the fourth row, he was on his phone writing notes the whole way through the show. And he doesn't realise, he's on the spectrum, my dad's autistic, very much so. And I don't think he realises it, that the way he communicates isn't how you should communicate with someone just after they've come off stage. And and I just told him, I was like, you're such a cunt. I was like, who the fuck are you? Don't talk to me. I was like, I was so angry, and we were on the train and I was in tears because he'd really upset me. And he was like, the show will be good, but I've got all these notes. I was like, I don't want your notes, Daddy. It's not your show, it's my show. And then my mum went, rang me and she went, why are you crying? And I was like, Daddy didn't like the show. And she went, put me on the phone to him. And I hear, you wanker, why the fuck are you making her cry? You fucking idiot. Right, you're not sleeping on my bed tonight. You're sleeping in the spare room. And then Daz like, well, I think it is a very good show. I just wanted to make sure I'm giving her. No, don't, she's a fuck. She knows what she's fucking doing. You sissy, you could have. Right, and goes back into my phone. And she's like, right, don't be fucking mean to your father. He's just trying to do the best for you. You just, and I'm like, well, fuck you, Mum. I just want to do my show. Right, well, don't talk to me then. And then I block her phone number and I don't talk to her for a week. And then she calls me and she goes, right, I hear you doing very well. How's Edinburgh? And I go, I miss you, Mum. She goes, right, do you want a Hufflepuff jumper? Because I know you're in Hufflepuff. And I'm like, I really want a Hufflepuff jumper. I found it's insane. It's absolutely batshit insane. But it has to be a part of my comedy because of that. I think, basically, style out. It's okay. Embrace your weirdness. Read. Just read. That's all I do. I read. Get lost in books and see as many shows as you can. And also, even if you're not creative, do something creative. Like do an improv class or just write. I think writing is integral. Writing diaries. It's a really good way of how I keep involved. I know when I'm depressed because I stop writing. And I go, why have I stopped writing? Oh, it's because I don't want to write about something. And then I realise, God, I feel like I've not talked about comedy, Stuart. I feel like I've just talked about my feelings.
You've talked loads about comedy.
Oh, God. I'm such a wanker. I feel like people are going to listen to this and go, wow, she's such self-involved.
I don't think so. What do you want out of the next 10 years of comedy?
I would love to keep on doing shows. I like making shows, theatre shows for the circuit. I think next year I'd like to ban reviewers. I just don't care about them anymore. I like audiences. And I feel like I've done my bit. I feel like I've received my ones and my twos and my fives and my fours. I feel like I've received all the constructive feedback I could get. I don't want to receive school reports anymore.
I've just thought The Ordeal would be a great name for your next show.
The Ordeal, yeah. I do know if I do another show, the next, because I'm doing Medusa, which is the hour of before Medusa's death, and that's a theatre show that I'm making with the Southampton Theatre, the Nuffield Theatre in Southampton.
Wow.
That's a serious theatre show that we're doing.
Oh, wow.
And that will be really fun, and I'm looking forward to doing that. But I know the show I want to make after this, there are loads of ideas, but one, I want to perform all my favourite horses from history. The other one is I want to perform all of Stephen King's books in an hour.
Did you refer to that on stage? Yeah. Yes, because I immediately was like, oh, God, yes, I want to see that
one. I want to do the whole of the show. I want to do the whole thing because I'm obsessed with Stephen King.
Brilliant.
My mum's obsessed. My mum used to dress me and my sister up as the twins from The Shining when we were little and make us stand at the end of corridors. I want to do that and... What was the other idea I had?
Will it get harder to bite off more than you can chew the more used you get to attempting the impossible? Like, will it actually, like...
When you
think to yourself, I'm going to do all of Stephen King, like, I can't imagine what that would be, but, I think Elf could do that. Does that mean it's harder because now you are more capable, so there is less fear and adrenaline?
But it always gets harder because with the more things that you do, the more opportunities that come, the more things you're aware of, like... I never had the chance that I have now that people come up to me and go, hi, Elf, what lighting state do you want before you show? I never had that 4 years ago. And now I can go, oh, can you do a crossfading? Can I have a blackout? And do you have a haze machine? And with more of those, become more ideas, become more limitations, become more... the more opportunity, the more availability and knowledge you have of the industry, the more things get... It's always going to be complicated because next year, if I do The Raven, that's what the horror show will be about, will be called The Raven, because I want to do Edgar Allan, you know, The Raven, Nevermore, and do horror-based. But I was thinking, how could you make it a scary show? Do a comedy show, immersive, headphones, or I don't know, how to do it? Like, do I have other actors in it? How do you make a stand-up show that's a horror show that's scary at the same time as it's funny, but it's, like, properly scary? I don't know. I just don't know.
And just a thought, because I'm interested that you're doing sort of, if not straight serious theatre, non-comedy theatre, Medusa. What are some of the... How do you do that? Do you just make a comedy show that isn't funny? Like, what's the difference? What's the difference in how you make a show?
Well, it's with
given the nature of the... You know, your approach to comedy is kind of games and limitations. Mm. are there parallels, or is it a completely different thing? You write a script and try and make
it's
drama.
It's weirdly a different thing, because with comedy, it's predominantly quite a loner sport. I mean, I worked with Aitor from Spy Monkey for a week in April on this, because I really needed to play with someone. I needed to play with a grown-up. And Spy Monkey, I absolutely adore. Yeah, I just think they're phenomenal. And it was lovely to work with him. But with this show, there's a team of us. There's Jess, there's Jasmine, there's Ian, there's a whole gang of us who are making the music, the set, the tech, the lighting. We're an ensemble. Even though I'm the performer, it's not me going, right, this is Medusa, this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. We spent a week, we had a big R&D week in Southampton in May, which is, again, it's why it's been difficult building this show, because at the same time, the moment Edinburgh finishes, I go straight to Southampton for the intensive creation week of Medusa. And so we did loads of research around horror and about set building and lighting, and we've got live musician in it, and it's also, it's not for a comedy audience, it's for a theatre audience, so it means the laughter is slightly different, the reactions are different, 50 minutes, it's a teamwork. And also I'm fulfilling my role with what everyone else wants me to be in it. I don't know how it's going to turn out. It's very exciting. Ian, who's the director, also went to Goliath, but before me. And so, again, we've come from a similar background. I have no idea. I like going into the unknown and just seeing what's going to happen. But it's okay, like, what's the worst that's going to happen with anything is that it's going to be shit. I was like trying to explain that to my dad. I was like, look, the worst thing that's going to happen with this show is I get zero reviews, everybody hates it, nobody comes. I'll have to work loads next year to pay back the debt. But I'll just do a better one. Like, I'll be financially ruined, but I can get out of that. Like, I can work and we can fix it and I can be better. But nobody dies. Nobody dies from what we're doing. The only person who I need to emotionally worry about is me, mentally. And as long as I'm making sure I'm drinking my fluoxetine and I'm going swimming and I don't drink, I'm going to get through this. You know? And maybe that's the luxury that I've had of, again, the thing you were saying about class and upbringing. I've been going in so much unconditional love. Not without its bite. But my mum always said to me, when I've done gigs and it's been going really bad. Like, I had a horrible gig at the Gong Show once and the audience shouted, we're going to rape you, and it was horrible. And I remember my mum went, baby, these gigs aren't worth it. No, this gig isn't worth it. Look, do you want me to ring them? And I'll say, you're too ill. And I said, no, mum, it's not like... Who do I need to talk to? Who do I need to talk to say you're too tired? You're too tired to do this. It's ridiculous. Right, I'm coming up, I'm picking you up and we're taking you home. Mum, no. Right, for God's sake, cancel the gig and get into bed, you idiot. Do you want to die? I'm like, okay, I'm sorry, I love you.
Thanks, Elle.
Thanks for having me.
So that was Elf. Thank you so much to her for coming along. Please get well soon, Elf, to the best of your ability, the best of your situation. And please keep making incredibly interesting, challenging and very, very funny work. So you can find out all about Elf Lyons by Googling Elf Lyons and following all of the people are forever going, oh, where can I find out about work? There's an internet. Get on the internet. I can't do all the work for you. But she's on Twitter. She's on all the, you know, platforms and stuff. So if you're on them, search for her and you'll find her. So that's good. Thank you, Nathan, for your editing and uploading skills. Thank you to podcast consultant Pete Dobbing. Thanks to Rob Smouten for the music, as usual. And also, there's no extra material from this one, because as you heard at the beginning, we did a good 15 minutes before realising I hadn't turned on the equipment. So no extra stuff from this episode, but extras from almost every other episode, as well as an advance copy of the interview with No Such Thing as a Fish, the QI Elves podcast. You can find all of that stuff on the private podcast only for subscribing donors, insiders to this podcast. It's comedianscomedian.com/insiders. You can find out how you can support this show. It genuinely makes a difference to me and my life and my family's life, and pays me a little something for all the effort that
that goes into these. If you have been enjoying this show for free and thinking, oh, maybe I should chuck something Stu's way, you can join for as little as whatever you want per month, and you get access to this whole private podcast with loads of other projects, loads of extra material from episodes with Dara, James Acaster, Sarah Millican, loads and loads of stuff, and the pre-release specials every once in a while, including the No Such Thing as a Fish live episode from the King's Place Podcast Festival in London. That's all of that, and I will now post-amble at you very briefly. But that concludes the show. I'll be back with you soon with more red-hot content. So there's a couple of things to talk about at the moment. One is the intense lack of sleep brought on by having a new child again, and the sudden rush of, oh Christ, I remember, babies. I had to write 2-hour-long stand-up shows to get out of my system. Quite how hard I found the first 18 months of the Boutros' life. And I have to admit to having had a sudden rush of, oh God, it's going to be really difficult, it's probably going to be harder. I immediately lost all respect for anyone who has only one child. Oh yeah, tell me about your problems. But of course, the Boutress, as someone suggests, future girl be called, or indeed present girl. She's wonderful. She makes me very happy. Life is brilliant. You know, I remember saying that I got. You remember? Did I ever say this to you or in a show or something? Life with a child is meaningful but hard. You know, it used to be easy and meaningless. Oh, my life was easy. Oh, it was meaningless. And now it's meaningful and really difficult. And now it's extra meaningful and extra difficult. Also, it's just sleep, isn't it? It's so hard to stay positive when a toddler is throwing a tantrum and you've only had 4 hours sleep. So my wife manages it. I don't know. That's just one of those. That's one of those deep down unfair mental health things whereby she is presented with a challenge and just digs deep and copes with it and deals incredibly fucking well with it, and I crumble and go to pieces and turn out not to be the man I thought I was. I'm not going to be too hard on myself because there's no advantage to doing that. But if there's any, I don't know what. Could we get like a male nanny? Is there such a thing as a sort of a dad nanny? Can I switch my job? Sounding dangerously close to polyamory now, isn't it? But wouldn't it be good if there was a sort of a dad recovery service where a better man than I could step in and parent better and more calmly and with more positive mental health than I sometimes can muster in order to give my wife a break? Because now is the time when I should be giving her just all the support in the world. And I mean to, and I do my best, but all I'm saying now is I've remembered how hard it is, and I've remembered how badly I fare when I don't get enough sleep, and that was always what I was scared about, having kids. I won't go into any further detail on that, but shout out to any parents of 2 or more children out there. Holy fuck. But we're great. Mother and baby very well. I didn't chat about this much last time, and I won't go into too much more detail now, but we're all great, and thank you so much for everyone that said, either on email or in the Facebook group or on Twitter or even Instagram, which I'm doing, at ComComPod these days, slightly more frequently than usual. Thank you, everyone, for all your wonderful messages. I'm not going to put pictures of her anywhere besides the one that's already up there because I don't feel that I have her consent to do that. And anyway, by the time she's 6, the idea of having your face just out there in the world will surely be this preposterous thing that fogies are into. Like, do you know what I mean? Can you not imagine the children of 20 or 30 years from now going, what, you just put your picture on the internet? You just gave away your image all over the place. Out of what? Desperation? Some sort of glee at the idea that someone in New Zealand could look at your face? Why would you do that? So I'm hedging my bets in the same way that I never got a tattoo because I remember writing band slogans, you know, movie quotes and band names on my pencil case and as a child and then getting annoyed with them and wanting to change it and having to buy a new pencil case. That's why I never got a tattoo. And that's why I'm not putting pictures of Future Girl online. No one asked, but that's why. Much cooler if I just didn't do it, wouldn't it? I learned that now. Is a non-baby related thing. Spotify. I'm not going to advertise it. Some of you may be listening to this on Spotify, but I am. Look, oh, I said this was non-baby. It's completely wrapped up in the Boutros. I'm getting into so much new music now because whenever he listens to something, he goes,
put this on my playlist. And we've got this playlist online with something like 130 songs on it now, most of them by people I've never heard of. And I'm having this new, like, I know your children are supposed to teach you stuff, but I didn't realise it started when they were two. Like, there's bands I like now that I have no idea, that I've no idea who they are. And I think as a younger man, my appreciation of music was sort of based on whether I believed in what the person was saying, enjoyed the melody, liked the sound of the voice, you know, all of those sort of things, which basically I ended up being incredibly picky and choosy, because if someone's voice was great but I didn't like their lyrics, then I'm like, no, I can't get into them. So I only like six bands and I just buy everything that they've ever done. And now I feel like, no, if he's wiggling, it's a banger. And it goes on the list. What I realise, though, is that you can't play Radio 1 in the car. Not that I do that, I'm in my 40s. The danger is, like, if he likes a thing, he's like, put it on the playlist. You go on Radio 1, it's all laser-guided at two-year-olds. It's all big, hooky, brassy stuff designed for kids to get addicted to. He's like, playlist, playlist, this one goes on the playlist. So suddenly our carefully cultivated, list of really exciting music that I'm all excited about has got a load of stuff on it that I'm having to secretly delete while he's in bed, and then he realises I've done it and all turns into a saga. But is it good? I feel like one of my comedy albums is on Spotify. Hey, there's a plug. If I get another 11,000 plays, then who knows, maybe I'll make another $34, which happened last year. It was funny. So I benefit from it in a tiny way, and it's one of those things, I suppose, where you want visibility. But John Hopkins has released a new album, The Singularity, and it's fantastic. But I've heard it on Spotify. I don't know when I'm going to get the chance to buy a ticket to go and see him live. So he just, I don't need to discover him there. I'm just like, oh, great, that's there, I'll have that. Now I'm listening to that, and he makes nothing. So I don't, you know. Hey, this is like a very gentle observational comedy from 5 years ago. But it takes me that long to catch up often. That'll do me for now, I think. There's other stuff. I'm in the cellar. Hey, here's a little note. If you're every so often, people get in touch with me and say, hey, Stu, I'm... I'm going to be quite cruel now. People frequently get in touch with me and say, hey, Stu, I've been so motivated and inspired by The Comedian's Comedian that I'm going to start my own podcast doing exactly the same thing. Other people also get in touch saying, I'm going to do my own podcast, which is nothing like yours. And I suppose I appreciate them more. But people often ask me what the sort of what the setup is. And I'm currently recording this, leaning. This is a thing I saw. I didn't even get instructions for this. I just saw a picture of it and I thought that'll work. I hope that you've noticed the sound quality of the blurbs today is slightly better, because I am talking into my phone, a OnePlus 5, if you're interested. That's OnePlus in letters, all one word, and then numeral 5. I mean, they didn't think about that in advance, did they? So it's a OnePlus 5, which I like very much. And I'm talking into a block of inch-thick memory foam that I bought for a bit of campervan bed that never happened, that I have stuffed into a cardboard box. And I think in doing that, I've taken echo out of the place. I'm sort of facing into the box. And I couldn't balance it at height. So the whole time I've been talking to you, I'm sort of standing like, you know, those awful Tory, like, I've got my legs 1 metre apart because it shows power. I'm sort of doing that and bending down and talking to the box. I hope you all get in touch to go, God, the sound quality's better in this episode, because this is painful. But I do feel like I've sort of MacGyvered myself a studio. So could you do me a favour? Get in touch, info@comedianscomedian.com, and just lie about the sound quality. Or Twitter or Instagram, @comcompod. Just get in touch and publicly go, whoa, wasn't the sound quality good? And then I'll feel like I'm not just shouting into a box, shouting into a foam void. Ugh, there's an autobiography. That'll do for now. I think normal service is going to be resumed from now on. I hope I can keep cranking these out with the content that I skillfully harvested during Edinburgh. So there's a few more of these to come. Who have we got? Imran Yusuf. We've got, brilliant. We've got the wonderful and bizarre Sean Morley, Laura Lex, Laura Davis, both of those absolute belters. And I feel like there's three or four more as well. Jake Johansson, who I managed to nab in maybe June this year when he was in London supporting Russell Peters on tour. He is Jake's wonderful. So I he's from the Jake This podcast. He's a very, very funny, lovely, warm guy. He's almost like, he's a little bit like an American Will Anderson. Is that helpful, or is that more obtuse? Anyway, loads more great stuff going, and I'm going to go now and do some more parenting. And that's all for now. I'll speak to you soon.
Hold up.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.